You're listening to Access Utah. We're talking rock and roll on the program today. Ed Casilia, for several years, was a rock critic for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. And in that role, and later as a publicist, he had contact with and even struck up friendships with many of the big names in rock and roll. We've been talking about the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and several others. We'll get talking about George Harrison, with whom Ed Casilia struck up a friendship. And if you'd like to join this conversation on It Rocked, Recollections of a Reclusive Rock Critic, that's the book. Here's how you do that. 1-800-826-1495 is the phone number. 1-800-826-1495. And you can join us on email at upraxcess@gmail.com. upraxcess@gmail.com. Ed Casilia, I'd like to have you compare and contrast a band live versus recorded. You say you weren't as impressed as many other people about Led Zeppelin. Are you talking about the live performance?
Yes, I am. You know, I know, as you mentioned earlier, it may be heretical in talking about rock and roll and not thinking of Led Zeppelin as this great rock and roll juggernaut. You know, I saw them several times, and the thing that was amazing to me was, you know, on record, you get this full, big, great sound and all of this sort of thing. Well, Jimmy Page, the guitar player, you know, he'd played session work many. He'd played with Herman's Hermits. He'd played with Tom Jones. He'd played as part of the Yardbirds, you know. He'd played with a lot of English acts over the years and produced records. Great studio session guy. The thing that he learned and the thing that he did a lot of, you know, was double tracking, triple tracking. You know, there would be 12 guitar tracks on a Led Zeppelin song. It's impossible for anybody to do that live. So you would go and see the band, and, you know, and particularly with that band that had quite a reputation for chemical influences and things, it could sometimes be spotty, and it really kind of depended on where they were all at when you saw them live. You know, moments of brilliance, moments of pedestrian kind of playing. So, you know, listening to a Led Zeppelin album is not quite the same as having seen them live. They just did not sound the same. They didn't perform the same. And that's not to say that, you know, going to a concert, you want to hear them play it exactly as they do on the record. But there were a lot of holes, in my mind at least, when you went and saw them. You know, they were powerful, they were charismatic, and there were times when Jimmy Page could rip off an incredible lead guitar lick. But there were also down moments. So I was never a huge, huge Led Zeppelin fan.
The way to reach us, we're talking with Ed Casilia. His book is It Rocked, Recollections of a Reclusive Rock Critic. The way to reach us is 1-800-826-1495. The phone number, 1-800-826-1495. You can reach us by email as well, upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. We have another 10 minutes left in the conversation. We have a caller, George from Cedar City. George, glad you called. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hello, Ed.
Hi.
I remember when you were out here from the Spectrum for a number of years.
Thank you.
It was a while ago. Appreciated your work.
Thank you.
A friend of mine, Doug Haywood, who was with the Jackson Browne Band for years, has performed here, and of course you wrote about him some time ago when he first performed in our area. I'm going actually to see Jackson Browne next week in a benefit concert in Southern California.
Oh,
maybe
be a
you
great
could
show.
Kind of talk about that L.A. music scene in the early 70s, the number of artists were in the vanguard there, and what was that like?
Well, you know, a lot of them settled in a place called Laurel Canyon. They called it Laurel Canyon Music. You know, Joni Mitchell was there. The members of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and sometimes Young, hung out there. Jackson Browne came out of Orange County and hung out there. You know, Ladies of the Canyon, Joni Mitchell's album, was sort of written as a bit of a tribute to that area. It was kind of a place where they all lived, and they were neighbors, and they hung out, and they'd get together and play music. And it was pretty pretty incredible because, you know, what came out of that was at a party one time, Graham Nash, Stephen Stills, and David Crosby ran into each other and just started singing, playing music, you know, some oldies and things, and all of a sudden discovered, hey, you know, this sounds kind of nice. Let's see what we can do with this, you know. And we've seen what they did with that, with Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. It was the kind of musical epicenter of L.A., you know. Previous to that, New York was where it came from, the Brill Building, you know, Carole King, Neil Diamond, the songwriters that came out of New York City. It was the kind of music capital of the United States, and that's where the business was. That's where it came from, and it was a little bit more urban flavored. It became more of an East Coast thing as it developed with bands like the Four Seasons and the Young Rascals and some of the Eastern flavored, you know, East Coast flavored bands. Well, L.A., of course, you know, the endless summer and the beautiful weather and the beaches and whatever kind of became a magnet, and a lot of musicians gravitated there. The industry moved there, and it became the new place, you know, the Whiskey A Go-Go on the Sunset Strip and the different clubs that were up and down the boulevard there. It's where a lot of bands cut their teeth. Buffalo Springfield, The Doors, you know, you can go on and on. And it became the place for music in the United States, you know, and a lot of these musicians and artists, songwriters, ended up in Laurel Canyon. It's a beautiful spot up in the hills, and it was very secluded and quiet and a place where they could go and play their music and just kind of hang out and be rather undisturbed. So the music that came out of there was a certain energy that happened, you know, and there was this cooperative type thing. I mean, from Peter Tork, who was one of the Monkees, who actually was a very, very talented folk musician long before the TV show. You know, he and David Crosby were buddies. They knew Stephen Stills. Stephen Stills had auditioned to be in the Monkees. They didn't like his hair and teeth and his voice. So he said, well, I know this guy. So he sent Peter Tork in to audition, and you know, he got the gig. It became kind of this co-op thing. It was very communal. It was sharing ideas and sharing music and very laid back, which added to some of that kind of flavor of the music. And yeah, there were some great musicians that came through there.
Thanks, George. Appreciate that. I want to, before we end, we have about 6 minutes left, Ed Casilio. I want to have you tell a very interesting story about how you met George Harrison. It kind of gets into the weirdness of celebrity. And this is George Harrison after the Beatles in, I think, Southern California.
1977 in Southern California.
Yeah, and he was into racing, I think.
Well, I was still a sports writer at the time, and I was covering the Long Beach Grand Prix Formula One race, which was a fantastic event, but it was a very lengthy, very time-consuming, very, very tiring thing to work on because, you know, it goes from early in the morning until the sun goes down, and then you're doing interviews and you're talking to people and you're writing stories, and it makes for very, very, very long days. The Long Beach Arena, which is down along the shore, is where they had the press area and the pit area. It was filled with the Formula One racing cars and drivers and crews, and it had been an incredibly tiring day, and I'm getting ready to leave, and I'm walking out the door and going around the corner of the arena when literally I bumped into this person. I mean, we bumped, you know, we crashed into each other, because it was dark, we didn't see any each other or whatever, and I go, oh, excuse me, sorry, I didn't see you, and I hear this voice say, that's okay, I didn't see you either, you know, you okay, and immediately recognized the voice and appeared in the darkness. I said, George? Hello? And he kind of looked up and we kind of st- stepped over to where it was a little more light, and we conducted a little conversation. And of course, the first thing that takes over is your reporting instincts, and you say, well, you got a couple of minutes, can we talk? And he said, well, no, I have another commitment that I'm off to. He said, but I'll be here tomorrow, and we can get together then. I'm thinking, okay. And we shook hands. I said, nice to meet you and all that. And I said, yeah, right, I'm going to run into him among 90,000 other people, and we're going to get an interview. So didn't think much of it, didn't think it would happen. Well, the next day I'm back in the pit area there at the arena and walking through, and I see George with his soon-to-be wife, Olivia, kind of standing over near one of the open areas, and he kind of waved and smiled, and okay. So he remembered, and we walked over and started talking, and, you know, we're doing this interview, very pleasant, nice guy answering the questions. We kept it pretty much on the racing thing because at that point, you know, there was a lot of animosity among the Beatles, and it wasn't a Beatles type story. It was running into George at the race, you know. And so we were talking, and we're just about done with the interview when all of a sudden it seemed like reporters from all over the world just kind of fell from the sky. We hadn't really noticed, but there had been a crowd of these reporters who were covering the race who suddenly were encircling us. And you know, I can certainly understand that because you've got a Beatle there. And so we're talking, and these guys start putting microphones and shouting questions, and they're going back and forth and trying to interrupt our interview. And George was very cordial. He realized it was my interview and just was answering questions that I asked. And finally, I'm done. I've got all that I need. And the absurdity is, I mean, we started out about 3 feet apart, you know, just a comfortable conversation going on. And by the time we were finishing up, we were practically nose to nose, and were crushed in by this group of reporters. So, you know, the absurdity of it hit me, and I just started asking him these really stupid questions, like teen magazine, what's your favorite color? Is this still blue? And those hard candy jelly bean things they used to throw on stage. And he looked at me, and he had this kind of odd look, and then he got it. He knew that I was putting them on, you know, the people that were there. And so he started answering in absurdities as well. And it was really kind of funny. It was our in-joke, and these people are thinking that, you know, we're talking about the greatest and most important thing in the world, and we're just having fun with it. And finally, you know, we finish up, and I say thanks, and off I go, and off he goes. And I ran into him later, kind of hiding out in the shadows in the arena. And I said, you know what, man, I used to think that being a Beatle would be the greatest thing in the world. It's not. And he looked and he said, this is my life every day.
Yeah, that's I guess that sums it up. It's a good place to end. We're just about out of time. The book is It Rocked, Recollections of a Reclusive Rock Critic. The author is Ed Casilia. For several years, he was a rock critic for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. And just about anyone you would care to read about is in this book. Very interesting. Including, you witnessed Ed Casilia temper tantrum by Pete Townsend, and many other things behind the scenes. You'll have to get the book to read to find out about those. Ed Casilia, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for having me on, Tom. Good to be back home on UPR with you.
It's been great for us too. And join us tomorrow, of course, for Access Utah. For producers Katie Swain and Bennett Purser, I'm Tom Williams. Thanks so much for listening today.
Commentator Thad Box.
Mark Twain said life, liberty, and property are not safe when the legislature is in session. The 2014 session of Utah's legislature has a chance to prove Mr. Twain wrong. They can do something really important this year: clean up corruption and restore the confidence of the people. For many years, it was commonly known that Attorneys General Swalla, Shurtleff, and other elected officials were palling around with owners of online gambling businesses, payday loan shops, shady real estate dealers, and other questionable operations. When businessman Jeremy Johnson secretly recorded Swalla at a Krispy Kreme shop in Orem, possible crimes by a number of elected servants became public. The legislature hired a special counsel to investigate Swallow's alleged crimes and determine whether he should be impeached. Swallow resigned in early December. The committee asked their special counsel to give a report on his investigation. Committee members looked sick as investigators skillfully presented a timeline with evidence that crimes had likely been committed and that potential evidence had been altered or destroyed. Legislators I know want to fairly serve the people of Utah. Over the years, I've known a number of elected representatives personally. Some are my friends. Some have represented me in legal matters. I have no indication that any of them have or would use their position for personal gain. Most are really good folks. But if the legislature really wants to clean up this mess, now's the time to do it. Because of actions of a few, many citizens simply do not trust their elected officials. Significant changes must be made in the full view of the people they serve. Continuing the Swallow investigation and expanding it to others is a good first step. Even more important is changing the ways state government operates, making every action visible and accountable. They must make it easier to put initiatives to a vote of the people, nominate candidates for office, and change the rules of the way we are governed. Too expensive is not an excuse for delay. We citizens have every right to expect the good people we elect to stand up to a few bullies and clean house. This legislative session is the time to start. This is Thad Box.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Office of Research and Graduate Studies, Sunrise Sessions, featuring Sean Fisher, head of USU Graduate Program in Theater Art, presenting Through the Eyes of the Audience, a Theater Artist's Measure of Success, available on upr.org, UPR2, Tuesday, February 18th at noon and 8 p.m., and by Dr. Carl Breitenbach, practicing evidence-based family medicine at Basin Clinic in Vernal since 1987. With emphasis in complete family health, including obstetric and pediatric care. Information is at basinclinic.com.
Waste not. Help keep your drinking water safe. Eliminate or protect cross connections between your water system and a contamination. And have your backflow preventers tested annually.
Waste Not is made possible by the Logan City Public Works Water Conservation Department. Information at loganutah.org/publicworks.
Utah State University Online was recently recognized by U.S. News & World Report for its online bachelor's degree program based upon student engagement, faculty credentials, peer reputation, student services, and technology. More than 200 universities were ranked and included public, private, and for-profit institutions. Congratulations to USU for its recent recognition.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM HD1 Logan.